Disc 4. Chapter 14. There is no other. Chapter 11 from The Mysterious Stranger by Mark Twain. The dream marks are all present. You should have recognized them earlier. Mark Twain. For as much as a year, Satan continued these visits, but at last he came less often, and then, for a long time, he did not come at all. This always made me lonely and melancholy. I felt that he was losing interest in our tiny world, and might at any time abandon his visits entirely. When one day he finally came to me, I was overjoyed, but only for a little while. He had come to say goodbye, he told me, and for the last time. He had investigations and undertakings in other corners of the universe, he said, that would keep him busy for a longer period than I could wait for his return.
And you are going away and will not come back any more?
Yes, he said. We have comraded long together, and it has been pleasant for both. But I must go now, and we shall not see each other any more.
In this life, Satan? But in another?
We shall meet in another, surely. Then, all tranquilly and soberly, he made the strange answer. There is no other. A subtle influence blew upon my spirit from his, bringing with it a vague, dim, but blessed and hopeful feeling that the incredible words might be true, even must be true.
Have you never suspected this, Theodore?
No. How could I? But if it can only be true...
It is true.
A gust of thankfulness rose in my breast, but a doubt checked it before it could issue in words, and I said, But we have seen that future life, seen it in its actuality, and so...
It was a vision. It had no existence.
I could hardly breathe for the great hope that was struggling in me. A vision.
Life itself is only a vision, a dream.
It was electrical. By God! I had had that very thought 1,000 times in my musings.
Nothing exists. All is a dream. God, man, the world, the sun, the moon, the wilderness of stars, a dream. All a dream. They have no existence. Nothing exists save empty space and you.
I?
And you are not you. You have no body, no blood, no bones. You are but a thought. I myself have no existence. I am but a dream. Your dream, creature of your imagination. In a moment you will have realized this. Then you will banish me from your visions, and I shall dissolve into the nothingness out of which you made me.
I am perishing already. I'm failing. I'm passing away. In a little while, you will be alone in shoreless space, to wander its limitless solitudes without friend or comrade forever. For you will remain a thought, the only existent thought, and by your nature inextinguishable, indestructible. But I, your poor servant, have revealed you to yourself and set you free. Dream other dreams, and better. Strange that you should not have suspected years ago, centuries, ages, eons ago, for you have existed companionless through all the eternities. Strange indeed that you should not have suspected that your universe and its contents were only dreams, visions,
fiction.
Strange, because they are so frankly and hysterically insane, like all dreams. A God who could make good children as easily as bad, yet preferred to make bad ones, who could have made every one of them happy, yet never made a single happy one, who made them prize their bitter life, yet stingingly cut it short, who gave his angels eternal happiness unearned, yet required his other children to earn it, who gave his angels painless lives, yet cursed his other children with biting miseries and maladies of mind and body, who mouths justice and invented hell, mouths mercy and invented hell, mouths golden rules and forgiveness multiplied by 70 times 7 and invented hell, who mouths morals to other people and has none himself, who frowns upon crimes yet commits them all, who created man without invitation, then tries to shuffle the responsibility for man's acts upon man, instead of honorably placing it where it belongs, upon himself. And finally, with altogether divine obtuseness, invites this poor abused slave to worship him. You perceive now that these things are all impossible except in a dream. You perceive that they are pure and puerile insanities, the silly creations of an imagination that is not conscious of its freaks. In a word, that they are a dream, and you the maker of it. The dream marks are all present. You should have recognized them earlier. It is true, that which I have revealed to you. There is no God, no universe, no human race, no earthly life, no heaven, no hell. It is all a dream, a grotesque and foolish dream. Nothing exists but you, and you are but a thought, a vagrant thought, a useless thought, a homeless thought, wandering forlorn among the empty eternities. He vanished and left me appalled, for I knew and realized that all he had said was true. Chapter 15. The Breakout Archetype. He's a grand, ungodly, godlike man, Captain Ahab. Doesn't speak much, but when he does speak, then you may well listen. Mark ye, be forewarned. Ahab's above the common. Ahab's been in colleges, as well as among the cannibals, been used to deeper wonders than the waves, fixed his fiery lance in mightier, stranger foes than whales. Herman Melville, Moby Dick. Ahab is an exquisite creation, and a unique one. No other character in literature, philosophy, or religion fulfills, even approximately, the description of the unknown archetype. Ahab not only fulfills it, he defines it. It is an archetype because it is a universal role in the human drama, transcending place, time, and culture, common to all, accessible to all. It is the unknown archetype because the awakened state is an undiscovered and unsuspected country. It is the ultimate archetype because it is the final archetype. And it is final because it breaks out of the confines within which the dramatic play of all archetypes occurs. Hence, the breakout archetype. The breakout archetype is unknown and will remain unknown. Very few people are likely to understand it conceptually, and far fewer will understand it directly, by playing or having played the role. And of those who understand it directly, nearly none will care to think or speak of it. Captain Ahab is definitive, as we'll see, because Melville knew exactly what he was doing when he created Ahab. Mary suggested that I list the reasons why I believe Captain Ahab was designed from the ground up to be the unknown archetype. She also suggested I list any features of this archetype that might be missing from Ahab. I brought her my list and my notes, and we worked on it together for a few evenings. Her deeper knowledge of Moby Dick, combined with her familiarity with Damnedest, allowed her to understand the archetype conceptually, so she was able to identify features common to both Ahab and the breakout archetype and cite supportive examples and contradictions. But even at that, my one all-crowning realization about Ahab and the breakout archetype was still at this point unsettled in my mind. I didn't discuss it with Mary then, or include it in this list. Among the most significant features of Ahab when considering the breakout archetype is his profound and mysterious relationship to fire. Fire is of the essence of the breakout archetype, and it is of the essence of Ahab. Melville makes this point many times in many ways, starting with Ahab's appearance. He looked like a man cut away from the stake, when the fire has overrunningly wasted all the limbs without consuming them, or taking away one particle from their compacted, aged robustness. Ahab is marked from head and face to neck, to feet, it's hinted, with a brand-like scar that resembles the perpendicular seam of a lightning strike on a great tree. We are given reason to suspect that Ahab's present state didn't begin when the whale took his leg, but sometime before that, when he got involved with worshippers and sacraments of fire. In one of the most sensational scenes in the book, the ship's masts are lit up like 9 candles as lightning blazes, and Ahab wields a flaming harpoon like a torch as he delivers the speech of his full defiance, after which, burning harpoon in hand, he addresses his panic-stricken crew. Petrified by his aspect and still more shrinking from the fiery dart that he held, the men fell back in dismay, and Ahab again spoke. "And that ye may know to what tune this heart beats, look ye here. Thus I blow out the last fear." And with one blast of his breath, he extinguished the flame. Moby Dick, viewed aright, is a very simple story. Man, ocean, and whale are ego, universe, and delusion. Fire is negation. Everything else is everything else. Ahab is in sole command of his ship on the sea of the infinite, launched on a kill-or-die quest to win his freedom. Armed with pure intent and a weapon tempered in blood and tempered by lightning, Ahab brings his entire being to bear on this one single purpose. The white whale is Ahab's dragon, his current lair of ignorance. It doesn't matter what the dragon represents, only that it exists. As long as there is a dragon, there's an Ahab, and as long as there's an Ahab, the hunt goes on. The following items are true of both Ahab and the individual who has taken the first step and is in the process of awakening, the breakout archetype. Ahab possesses purity of intent, monomania. Ahab acts, but does not reflect on the fruit of the act. Ahab is imperious, sovereign, and self-sovereign. Ahab is amoral. Ahab has lost a significant, irreplaceable part of himself. Ahab knows he is alone. He says, "Ahab stands alone among the millions of the peopled earth, nor gods nor men his neighbors." Ahab has undergone a radical transformation. Ahab and anguish lay stretched together in one hammock, rounding in midwinter that dreary, howling Patagonian cape. Then it was that his torn body and gashed soul bled into one another, and so interfusing made him mad. Ahab's objective is not, as it appears, the whale. The whale is just in the way. "If man will strike, strike through the mask, how can the prisoner reach outside except by thrusting through the wall? To me, the white whale is that wall, shoved near to me. Sometimes I think there's naught beyond, but 'tis enough." Further, come what may. That's what Ahab is saying. Those are the orders he sails under. It really has nothing to do with the whale. That's why no consensus has ever been arrived at as to what the whale and the whiteness of the whale represent. Beyond our furthest charted regions, where it is written, "Here be dragons," is where this hunt takes us. Each person's white whale is whatever keeps them from advancing in that direction. Ahab is hyper-Promethean in his defiance. Stealing fire from the gods is petty larceny compared to stealing illusion from Maya. "Thou canst blind, but I can then grope. Thou canst consume, but I can then be ashes. Take the homage of these poor eyes and shut her hands. I would not take it. The lightning flashes through my skull. Mine eyes ache and ache. My whole beaten brain seems as beheaded and rolling on some stunning ground. There is some unsuffusing thing beyond thee, thou clear spirit, to whom all thy eternity is but time, all thy creativeness mechanical. Through thee thy flaming self, my scorched eyes do dimly see it." Ahab is driven, not drawn. He does not act from desire. He is not pulled by the lure of some imagined betterment of self or world. He is not motivated by altruism or self-interest. Ahab cannot be swerved from his purpose. "Swerve me? The path to my fixed purpose is laid with iron rails, whereon my soul is grooved to run, over unsounded gorges, through the rifled hearts of mountains, under torrents' beds, unerringly I rush. Naught's an obstacle, naught's an angle to the iron way." Nor can he swerve himself.
"This whole act's immutably decreed. 'Twas rehearsed by thee and me 1,000,000,000 years before this ocean rolled. Fool, I am the fate's lieutenant. I act under orders."
Ahab is lashed to the front of a speeding locomotive hurtling toward imminent collision. He is a force of nature, a tidal wave that started as a minor oceanic event and which has swelled to a magnitude that can erase cities from the earth. "Nothing personal," says the wave. "It's immutably decreed." And so it is.
"All your oaths to hunt the white whale are as binding as mine. And heart, soul, and body, lungs and life, old Ahab is bound."
Here, five important expressions of the breakout archetype are voiced by Ahab in the space of five sentences.
"I'd strike the sun if it insulted me. For could the sun do that, then could I do the other, since there is ever a sort of fair play herein, jealousy presiding over all creations. But not my master man is even that fair play. Who's over me? Truth hath no confines."
That first sentence deserves a chapter of its own.
"I'd strike the sun if it insulted me."
"I will fight whatever enemy is before me," Ahab is effectively saying. "I am moving forward, and whatever stands in my way is therefore my enemy, and I will throw myself unreservedly against it." The battle is absolute, and because the goal is always forward progress, whatever is in the way is always what the battle is against. The goal is not survival or happiness or continued well-being. There is only one goal, and it is always the same: further. The second idea conveyed, that there is ever a sort of fair play herein, is a critical observation that is at the very heart of one's ability to stand up and fight the fight. The jealousy presiding over all creations can be understood as the balance of opposites, as in the yin-yang symbol. But the fact that Ahab understands that no task before us can be beyond us demonstrates a profound grasp of a rule that applies to all but is known by few. The universe always plays fair. If we must, we can. Third, "but not my master man is even that fair play." That fair play is the balance of opposites, causality, action, and reaction, the dualistic universe. Ahab is, in effect, declaring that he grasps non-dualism. The fourth important point to be drawn from this excerpt comes from these words, "Who's over me?" Those may sound like the words of a megalomaniac, but in Ahab, it's not ego talking. It's a man declaring his self-sovereignty, which is well established in the heart and mind of the breakout archetype. Anyone found over us would merely represent another obstacle to our progress. The fifth insight worth noting in this passage is this: truth hath no confines. This perfect statement is the diamond heart of both Captain Ahab and Moby Dick. It's one of those golden keys, like Not Two or Tat Tvam Asi, that unlocks the entire mystery. If truth hath no confines, then all confines are false. One who dedicates himself to striking through all confines must eventually arrive at truth. Hence, further. Ahab embraces his madness. He knows that it is indispensable to his endeavor. "For this hunt, my malady becomes my most desired health." Ahab views his madness as a form of sanity. He finds it strange that others seem to be in similar circumstances, but not reacting similarly.
When the life-battered blacksmith tells Ahab,
"I am past scorching, not easily canst thou scorch a scar," Ahab replies, "Thy shrunk voice sounds too calmly, sanely, woeful to me. In no paradise myself, I am impatient of all misery in others that is not mad. Thou shouldst go mad, blacksmith. Say, why dost thou not go mad? How canst thou endure without being mad? Do the heavens yet hate thee?
that thou canst not go mad? Ahab knows the truth of his being.
Nor a white whale, nor man, nor fiend can so much as graze old Ahab in his own proper and inaccessible being.
Compare that to the Bhagavad Gita. I say to thee, weapons reach not the life. Flame burns it not, waters cannot overwhelm, nor dry winds wither it, impenetrable, unentered, unassailed, unharmed, untouched, immortal, all arriving, stable, sure, invisible, ineffable, by word and thought uncompassed, ever all itself, thus is the soul declared.
And the Tao Te Ching.
He who knows how to live can walk abroad without fear of rhinoceros or tiger. He will not be wounded in battle, for in him rhinoceroses can find no place to thrust their horn, tigers no place to use their claws, and weapons no place to pierce. Why is this so? Because he has no place for death to enter. Captain Ahab utilizes non-ordinary ways of knowing. He breaks away from the conventional methods of navigation in favor of higher, more intuitive ways.
Curse thee, thou quadrant, dashing it to the deck. No longer will I guide my earthly way by thee.
Ahab states that he never thinks, only feels. His evil shadow, Fadala, is, among other things, an oracle, and serves Ahab as an unconventional source of knowledge. Ahab never counts cost. Nothing true can be destroyed. Nothing false exists. Ahab's quest will sink his ship, bring ruin upon its owners, kill his crew and two boys, leave his wife widowed and child fatherless, and destroy Ahab. It's not that he's unaware of the cost, but that he knows it to be irrelevant, a non-issue. Ahab is both player and spectator. He is undergoing the process as well as monitoring it. He often soliloquizes and shows himself to be in the observer mode.
What I've dared, I've willed, and what I've willed, I'll do. They think me mad. Starbuck does, but I'm demoniac. I am madness maddened, that wild madness that's only calm to comprehend itself.
Captain Ahab operates from a place of perfect certainty. He may be the source of tremendous conflict, but he himself is unconflicted. Although composed, like everyone, of two aspects, the living principle and the characterized mind, and although at times one seems haunted by the other, and although at times Ahab grieves for his lost humanity, the fact remains that he is clear and unwavering in his purpose. It cannot be clearly determined whether Ahab chose his destiny or was chosen by it, even by Ahab.
Is Ahab Ahab? Is it I or God that lifts this arm? If the great sun moves not by himself, but is an errand boy in heaven, nor one single star can revolve but by some invisible power, how can this one small heart beat, this one small brain think thoughts, unless God does that beating, does that thinking, does that living, and not I?
Ahab lacks the low enjoying power. All the normal pleasures of life are lost to him. He's in an amusement park he can't enjoy, or, as he calls it, paradise. Oh, time was, when as the sunrise nobly spurred me, So the sunset soothed. No more. This lovely light, it lights not me. All loveliness is anguish to me, since I can ne'er enjoy. Gifted with the high perception, I lack the low, enjoying power. Damned, most subtly and most malignantly, damned in the midst of paradise. Captain Ahab appears insane. Onlookers, both Ahab's crew and Melville's readers, assume that Ahab has chosen his course and could alter it, and since he doesn't, he must therefore be insane. Perfectly correct. There is no way to interpret Ahab as sane except within the context of the breakout archetype. Ahab is absolute. He is holding nothing back. He has no plan B, no secondary considerations or objectives. All the power and force of his being are being brought to bear on a single endeavor. He never acknowledges any future beyond Moby Dick. Ahab is still human, still in this paradigm. He displays genuine, heartfelt nostalgia for what he has lost, for the price he has paid. He's going, not yet gone. Ahab is overwhelmed. He is driven, as if possessed, to an incomprehensible fate, far beyond human bounds. What is it? What nameless, inscrutable, unearthly thing is it? What cozening, hidden lord and master, and cruel, remorseless emperor commands me, that against all natural lovings and longings, I so keep pushing and crowding and jamming myself on all the time, recklessly making me ready to do what in my own proper natural heart I durst not so much as dare. Ahab has no regrets or misgivings. He may feel overwhelmed and he may have nostalgic longings, but he does not express the wish that his situation was otherwise. Ahab doesn't pass the cup. To all outward appearances, he could turn back from the fate into which he's leading himself and his crew as easily as nodding his head. But the inward reality is very different. Ahab is discovering his role as he plays it. We see this when he throws down his quadrant, a tool of lower scientific knowing, in favor of a higher way of knowing. We also see it when he realizes that smoking no longer gives him pleasure. First comes realization. Oh, my pipe, hard must it go with me if thy charm be gone. Then resolution. What business have I with this pipe, this thing that is meant for sereneness, to send up mild white vapors among mild white hairs, not among torn iron-gray locks like mine? I'll smoke no more. He tossed the still-lighted pipe into the sea. Ahab is a deceiver. He is inwardly honest, not outwardly. He presents a false face to the world in order to carry out his task. Now in his heart, Ahab had some glimpse of this, namely, all my means are sane, my motive and my object mad. Yet without power to kill or change or shun the fact, he likewise knew that to mankind he did not long dissemble, in some sort did still. But his deceit is outward only. He is not deceiving himself. But that thing of his dissembling was only subject to his perceptibility, not to his will determinant. Ahab has already jettisoned most of himself. He is streamlined for the hunt. His ego is stripped to the bone.
He is no longer wasting his life force on projecting an outward self. In his more normal days, he must have been very conscious of presenting himself as pious, honest, honorable, dependable, worthy of a ship, worthy of marrying, worthy of sailing under. Now, all such considerations, except as necessary to his plans, are forgotten. He no longer maintains a religious, national, community, professional, or family identity. He is no longer burdened with the need to fulfill his role. "Let what will befall," says Ahab. He is resigned to his fate. He knows it's out of his hands, as shown when he parts from recently befriended Pip, knowing that death may be near for them both. "True thou art, lad, as the circumference to its center. So, God forever bless thee, and if it come to that, God forever save thee. Let what will befall." Ahab is a pure, unapologetic nihilist. He creates a weapon, a harpoon, which will weld together like glue from the melted bones of murderers. He tempers his weapon not in water, but in blood.
"Ego non baptizo ti in nomine Patris, sed in nomine Diaboli!" Deliriously howled Ahab, as the malignant iron scorchingly devoured the baptismal blood.
"I baptize you not in the name of the Father, but in the name of the devil." What does that mean? Does Ahab worship the devil? That might be how nihilism appears to many, but to Ahab, such a distinction would be meaningless. Ahab is not forging a tool to create or a container to preserve. He's forging a weapon to destroy. He is a nihilist. He seeks to arrive at the real by destroying the unreal. Correctly understood, this is also what Melville created in Moby Dick, a weapon to destroy. He told his friend Nathaniel Hawthorne, to whom Moby Dick is dedicated, that this line, "Ego non baptizo, ti in nomine Patris, sed in nomine Diaboli," is the book's motto. A final quality shared by Ahab and the breakout archetype is the one that keeps them undiscovered and unsuspected. By dwelling in the outskirts of the paradigm, they are effectively shrouded in the blurred edges of the observer's perceptual range. This shroud allows Ahab to stand before his crew unseen for what he really is, and Moby Dick to lay open before readers unseen for what it really is. The observer, not knowing the finiteness of his own reality, must say that Ahab is a great character, but ultimately insane. He must say that Moby Dick is a great book, but ultimately incomprehensible. He must say that the breakout archetype is interesting in theory, but of no practical value, because you can't break out of reality. Where would you go? Critics often point out the flaws in Ahab that lead to his downfall in order to support their theory that he is, in the Aristotelian sense, a tragic hero. But that's just the kind of error that must occur when we unknowingly translate from another paradigm into our own. That's why Moby Dick has defied all interpretations. It's about going somewhere that we don't even suspect the existence of. Captain Ahab is not a tragic hero. He exhibits no flaw and experiences no downfall. He is set on a single path from the time we first see him until his final encounter with the white whale. He is a harpoon that speeds unerringly toward its target. He never veers in the least, and in no sense does he fail to achieve his objective. The dissimilarities between Captain Ahab and the individual who has taken the first step and is launched on the trajectory of awakening are few. I have only noted one omission worth mentioning. Elation. Lunatic joy. Stark, raving happiness. Transcendental exaltation. Ahab appears at different times to be enraged, insane, reasonable, tormented, heartbroken, and introspective, but never radiantly triumphant, which he would most certainly be. He has every reason to be leaning off the prow of the Pequod, arms flung wide like Jack Dawson in the 1997 film Titanic, shouting, "I'm the king of the world." But what Jack Dawson was playing at would, for Ahab, be true. For Ahab, all the uncertainty, fear, doubt, mediocrity, pettiness, striving, ambiguity, and myriad other chains that bind us and weigh us down have been sliced away. His fate is known, his success certain. He is hurtling at thrilling velocity into perfect freedom. He knows it, and he would be unspeakably happy about it. Chapter 16. Irreconcilable Differences. Are you the new person drawn toward me? To begin with, take warning. I am surely far different from what you suppose. Do you suppose you will find in me your ideal? Do you think it's so easy to have me become your lover? Do you think the friendship of me would be unalloyed satisfaction? Do you think I am trusty and faithful? Do you see no further than this facade, this smooth and tolerant manner of me? Do you suppose yourself advancing on real ground toward a real, heroic man? Have you no thought, O dreamer, that it may be all Maya, illusion? Walt Whitman. I entered the offices of the public relations firm I've been asked to meet with. I'm a few minutes early for our appointment, so I sit in the waiting area and wait. After a while, Mark comes out and waves me in. It's his firm. He's a PR guy specializing in New Age books and music. I was made to promise that I'd at least talk to him while I was in Manhattan, so here I am. Unfortunately, I didn't sleep last night because I got caught up in a reading and note-taking jag and didn't look up from my work until sunrise. The result has been two meetings on personal business where the best I could do was collect information and postpone decisions, and now this meeting, which is really no more than a courtesy because I'm already pretty sure that it will bear no fruit, not the intended fruit, anyway. I was reading Moby Dick last night, and I was just about to turn off the light and go to sleep, very mindful of the fact that today would require more than usual alertness, when something caught my eye that I had missed in previous readings. Glimpses do ye seem to see of that mortally intolerable truth, that all deep, earnest thinking is but the intrepid effort of the soul to keep the open independence of her sea, while the wildest winds of heaven and earth conspire to cast her on the treacherous, slavish shore. But as in landlessness alone resides highest truth, shoreless, indefinite as God, so better it is to perish in that howling infinite than be ingloriously dashed upon the lee, even if that were safety. For worm-like, then, oh, who would craven crawl to land? Terrors of the terrible, is all this agony so vain? In landlessness alone resides highest truth. That woke me up instantly, and it wasn't until 5 hours later that I realized I had effectively sabotaged what was already sure to be an arduous day. Dragging Curtis along was a last-minute decision. I don't function well when tired, and I thought it would be a good idea to have an alert person around to keep me from getting hit by a non-metaphorical bus. On the ride in, we saw a sign advertising a Star Wars movie, and Curtis brought up the subject of a paper he had done for a college English class on the hero's journey as described by Joseph Campbell. He based his paper on the first Star Wars movie, using Luke Skywalker to illustrate the key points of the hero's progress. It was an interesting topic for Curtis, so it was interesting to hear him talk about it. He seemed to be finished before I thought he was finished, though. "Is that it?" I asked. "What do you mean? What else?" "What about relevance? Why is it important? What does it matter?" He doesn't seem to understand what I'm asking. How does it translate to real life? What is the value of understanding the hero's journey to you and me? "Oh, yeah," he says, nodding. "No."
"No?
We didn't cover that." I nod, too, pretending that makes sense to me, wondering if the reason it doesn't is because my brain is fogged in, but suspecting not. Mark is my third and last meeting of the day. Curtis is where I wish I was, across the street in a Greek restaurant, probably eating something involving slow-cooked lamb. Not only am I unrested, I'm unfed. I haven't eaten anything all day but half a cellophane-wrapped lemon pastry. I take the seat Mark indicates and allow my eyes to wander over the pictures and certificates on the wall behind his desk. There's a calligraphic rendering of a line from Rumi, very artfully done and expensively framed, prominently placed on his desk, facing whoever sits in the chair I now occupy. Beyond our ideas of right-doing and wrong-doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. Rumi. I read it several times, trying to see it through different eyes each time, trying to understand why he has it on his desk, facing his visitors, as if it's something he's personally saying to them, that he'll meet them in this improbable field. I'm too tired to think about this, but the stupid thing is staring right at me. I read it through my own eyes and can't make any sense of it. What does Mark think it means, I wonder? Does he view it as some sort of ideal or truism? A declaration of love or compassion? I've talked to the guy. I've seen the books he displays, the ones he wants people to know he likes. I have a pretty good idea of where he's located in the spiritual terrain, and I know exactly what kind of progress he's making. What I don't know is what he thinks that Rumi quotation means. It's like putting pretty Chinese calligraphy on your wall without knowing it says, "Round eye sucks." Mark speaks English, though. Maybe it was a gift from Coleman Barks. I can't think of another explanation. After all the pleasantries about how wonderful my book is and how everybody in the office has been stealing it from each other, we settle in around a conference table, everyone armed with notepads, pens, bottled water, and various other accoutrements of comfort and productivity. Mark sits at the head with Megan on his right. Janet and I sit across from each other near the middle. Rosalind, Mark's executive assistant, sits at the foot with calendar, notepad, appointment book, and a copy of Radio TV interview report spread out in front of her. Everyone knows why they're here, except me. These people are in the business of getting publicity for authors, reviews, talk shows, radio interviews, articles, and so forth. We're here to see about preparing me for a blitz of radio interviews that are really super, I'm told, because I can do them while sitting at my kitchen table in my underwear. Mark and his people know why they're here, but they don't yet know that their efforts shall not be rewarded, even though I've been pretty upfront about it. As delightful as the prospect of doing radio interviews while sitting at my kitchen table in my underwear may be, the visible purpose of this meeting me promoting a book is not going to happen. So why am I here wasting people's time? To find out what the true purpose is, the one behind the visible purpose. I don't do or not do things based on what's visible, but based on tendencies and currents. I've been asked to do this. It fell together with other plans. It's obviously worth doing for some reason, though not the stated one. Why then? Who knows? We'll see. Or not. Some of these questions are from people here in the office, Janet tells me. I actually went on the web for most of them. I just went to some spiritual news groups and asked for examples of the sort of questions people might ask of a purportedly enlightened spiritual teacher. I'm going to record this so that, once we're all comfortable with giving it a go-ahead, we can bring some focus and control to the process. We're not going to script you, but it's much better if you're able to develop a small repertoire of smooth responses and a few control techniques. We provide the radio stations with fact sheets and suggested questions which hosts like to stick to, but the topics can go pretty far afield, especially if they allow call-ins. Your ability to steer questions back into your own familiar territory will determine whether you sound crisp and knowledgeable or unfocused and garbled. Does all that make sense? Sounds good. Okay. We'll worry about intro, tone, and general banter later. For now, we just want to throw a variety of questions at you and see how the whole thing plays out. Ready? Ready. Okay. Question number one. Is it possible to have an experience without knowing who is having the experience? She looks up from her notes to await my answer. I just stare back at her. Behind my moronic facade lies the brain of a moron, scrambling to make sense of her words. After several moments of strenuous contemplation, I am able to articulate the following response. Huh? Excuse me? I don't think I understood the question. Is it possible to have an experience? Say it differently, please. You can't really ask a host or a caller to, I understand. I'm sorry. I don't know what to do with the question. Should I repeat it? I heard all the words. I just didn't catch the meaning or intent of the question. Can you rephrase it? This is the kind of thing we're looking for, she says, this sort of stumbling. Hopefully, we can get you to the point where you take a question that seems irrelevant or off-topic and just bring it smoothly back into your own area of expertise. It doesn't just happen. It's something you have to practice. That's why we're here. Okay, I guess this question would be the same as saying, can one ask a question without knowing who's doing the asking? Does that sound right? Janet nods tentatively. The question reduces to, can one be without knowing who one is? Or can the doer do without knowing the doer? It's either gibberish or ridiculous, don't you think? I don't know, she says. You can't say that to a caller, though. I look at Mark, who just shrugs. Okay, I say. Well, to me, it sounds like that. It sounds like someone is asking if it's possible to exist without knowing one's true nature. The way they asked it made it sound like a real question, and the way I rephrased it made it sound a little goofy. But that's basically what the question is really asking. Can I not know my true nature? It might be a little tough to answer without seeming to make fun of the person asking. Would you like to just go to the next question? Yes. Okay. Let's see. Is enlightenment a natural evolutionary step? Oh, that's a good one. The answer is no. If anything, enlightenment is evolution derailed. I mean, I take the question to mean evolution of a reincarnating individual or an evolving species, but the answer is the same either way. Evolution is about change, and enlightenment is about truth, which is unchanging. Evolution takes place in a larger context than day-to-day existence, but it's still encased within a dualistic context. In other words, evolution, growth, development, change, whatever, are all parts of the dramatic event of dualistic being. Enlightenment isn't. But wait, in Jack's mark, is enlightenment the end of the evolutionary line? You might get questions for clarification or follow-up, Janet points out. That's fine, I say. It's an amusing question. Will I myself experience growth beyond truth realization in this life? No. Will I reincarnate back into an ignorant state, which is to say, will unseen forces put me back to sleep? No. The question assumes the existence of a differentiated true self, like a separate entity, and that wouldn't be an accurate assumption.
Differentiated and true are mutually exclusive.
Then who are you talking to? You mean Jed McKenna? I have no idea. A character in a dream. You're enlightened, and you don't know who you are? Can't know? Doesn't matter? Don't care? You're talking about reconciling the dream state with reality, like it all has to add up. Everyone seems to get hooked on that, but you can't do it. Truth and non-truth are irreconcilable. Truth is, non-truth isn't. The false is purely an apparition. It exists only in the eye of the beholder. True and false aren't opposites. They're not like the black and white of the yin-yang symbol. There is no true self, and the false self is irrelevant. We can't insist on a truth that makes sense in the light of what we know because we don't know anything. Again, differentiated and true are mutually exclusive, not two halves of the whole.
Wow, this is good, says Janet. Nice, sharp sound bites. A little long on some of the answers, but we can trim them down. That's what this process is all about, making you succinct.
There's good material here. Very interesting. Okay, next question. If love is all there is, no way. Next question, please. Excuse me? Let's just move on. You don't want to answer? It's not a real question. It's a veiled assertion. Anyway, there's no question that starts, if love is all there is, that I could possibly answer. Even if the question was, if love is all there is, what's your favorite color? I couldn't answer. Is there something about love? Listen, I don't want to bore you guys to tears with all this. Do you really need to hear an explanation for every question I don't want to respond to?
I think so, said Janet.
For one, it's not boring. Two, it helps us come up with ways to maintain control in an open question format. I'll let you know if we're getting bored, she smiles. Okay. So, is there something about love? It has nothing to do with love. You can make it if intense gamma radiation is all there is, or if walnut veneer is all there is. The question is, really, if my beliefs are correct, then how do your beliefs fit in? I don't have any beliefs, and I can't answer a question that's based on someone else's. It's like asking, where does freedom fit within my confinement? It doesn't. If the question is love all there is, then we can proceed. But we can't simply grant the premise that love is all there is. Okay. Is love all there is? Sure. If someone wishes to refer to all there is as love, they're free to do so. I don't see where that would be a particularly useful thing to call all that is for the purpose of waking up, but you can call it whatever you want. God, universe, consciousness, Tao, and mind are all common examples. Why not love? She smiles, but chastises me. You're coming off a bit arrogant. I know it appears as arrogance, but it's really something else. and I'm doing my best to spin it in a fairly docile manner. She looks at me sternly. This isn't going well, is it? Depends on your preferred outcome. Don't you want to do interviews to promote the book? I smile. Next question, please. She looks at me quizzically. All right. Non-dual philosophy asserts that there's no such thing as non-dual philosophy. Let's try the next one. Hold on, says Mark. There's actually a large community of non-dualists around the world and on the web. And Advaita, of which you've said good things, actually means not two, as in non-dual. All right, I say, but it really doesn't make for a philosophy. Non-duality isn't a philosophy. Or if someone has turned it into one, then they've created a faux Advaita for personal or financial gain. Non-duality isn't a philosophy. It's a concept. You can't live a concept. You can liken it to two-dimensionality. You can have a conceptual grasp of two-dimensionality, but it's of no practical value in three-dimensional reality. And if you want to enter into two-dimensionality, you're going to have to leave three-dimensionality and your three-dimensional self to do it. That sort of statement is like a blanket indictment, says Mark. That might piss a lot of people off. Which brings us to the core problem at this table, I reply around a jaw-cracking double yawn. If I'm not pissing people off, I'm not doing my job. That's not bravado, that's the reality of it. I slap people. I slap them to wake them up because they have somehow, in some way, asked me to do so. But that dynamic isn't at work here. Here I'm supposed to be asking people to trust me, to believe me, to buy my book. I don't want to ask people to trust me or believe me. I wouldn't know how or why. You don't want people to trust you? Asks Megan, with some doubt in her voice. No, it's not a trust business. It's a self-verification business. We're all sitting here now with the seemingly common goal of promoting a book. But my priority isn't selling books. My priority is to try to communicate well. And this is taking me in the opposite direction from that. You guys have the job of turning me into a polished frontman for the book. I'm here to see if there's a way to participate in the promotion of this book as a favor to someone. But I'm pretty sure there's not. This earns me four sets of unamused stares. These guys are here because they want to receive a hefty check from the publishers, and I'm getting in the way of that. Mark spends the next few minutes explaining the book promotion process again in case there was something I was not understanding about the whole thing. They feel that Damdus can be a bestseller. But bestsellers don't just happen. They require careful planning and orchestration. I'm not keeping secrets from them. I explained to Mark the lengths we'd gone to in order to keep the book projects from turning back on me. I'm a private person, I told him. I've done my bit. I'm writing a book or two because it seems I have to, but that's it. I guess he thinks I'm kidding him or myself, though, because we proceed as if I hadn't said a word. I know it's not proper business meeting etiquette to rock back and forth while humming and drooling, so I try to look attentive and nod at the right times, but it's hard. I'm very tired. I'm very hungry, and nobody speaks my language. Okay, Mark says. Let's just keep going and see if we have something we can work with, okay? Okay, I say. Megan speaks up. Okay, here's a question. How can I live more deeply in the moment? I search the question for meaning and come up empty. What for? What? What do you want to live more deeply in the moment for? What does that mean? I'm working on being more fully present. Where? What? More present where? Deeper in the moment when? In the present, she says, like it's obvious. In the now.
When?
What?
What's the now? The present, time?
Yes, she says in a clipped way as if speaking to a dolt, which she may well be. Again, tiredness is throwing a shroud over everything, so I can't tell if I'm being thick or if I've descended into a place of thickness.
You want to be more present in the present.
Yes, she says. I'm trying to deepen my awareness, to live more fully in each moment. I feel like I'm trapped in a Monty Python skit.
Can I ask why? I ask tentatively, trying not to offend, but a little curious as to what the appeal might be of this deeper awareness.
To live more fully in each moment, she answers, speaking slowly to help me get it. To be in deeper touch with my life.
Okay. To be deeper in touch with your life.
And how would you go about that?
By deepening my awareness, she replies in exasperation. And it's finally clear to me that we're talking in circles and that I'm pissing her off for no good reason. Someone sold this woman something, and now she's all excited and coming to me to ask how it works. But I don't even know what the hell it is.
I don't know why anyone would think to ask me about living in the moment, is my polite attempt at getting away from this discussion. I often wonder how much of the New Age community is made up of people who had some nice experiences with dope, acid, mushrooms, or whatnot in their younger days, and would like to have those experiences again, maybe even make them permanent. It seems to me that a lot of teachers and techniques catch on with the spiritual crowd by promising them some hope of reliving their psychedelic glory days. If this woman, Megan, were a student of mine, someone with whom I could speak openly, I'd tell her to stop bullshitting herself and go take acid if that's what she wants to do. I know that's what I'd say because I've said it to dozens of people before. Figure out what you really want. If you don't, you'll continue having this Pavlovian response every time you hear the bells of a new spiritual snake oil salesman rolling into town. If what you want is to revisit the interior spaces to which drugs granted access, then stop dicking around with placebos and go find your drugs. If you can't find the drugs, or you've been scared or shamed away from them, then hook up with Stan Grof or Michael Harner or someone who's come up with a viable alternate route.
But you're a spiritual teacher, aren't you? Megan asks.
No, not really. More like the opposite. I sigh and rub my eyes. I don't want to get pulled into that kind of discussion. If someone calls and asks what I think of the flavor of the month teacher, technique or book, nothing good can come of it. It puts me into a no-comment position, or I'm going to come off as insulting, and I know that's not good.
Well, offers Janet, we can just set you up with a stock response to use whenever something like this comes up, something like, I recognize the merit of so-and-so's teachings, or I have a lot of respect for that book. You know, just have a stock response ready that's favorable but non-committal. I'll get a few ideas down on paper tonight, and we'll put together something you like. I don't bother telling her not to bother.
Oh, here's a good one, she says. Free will or predetermination?
Really, I'm not doing this to be difficult, but that's not a valid question either.
How can it not be valid?
It's not freestanding. It sits atop various assumptions that haven't first been verified. It presupposes other things to be accepted as true that can't be accepted as true.
See, that's the thing. For every person, at any time, there is only one right question. My job is to help them find it, not to answer it.
Thus spake Jed McKenna,
laughs Janet. You're not one of those fun teachers, are you? I'm sure not coming off that way. That's why this needed testing. In my ideal teaching environment, there's a structure and an accepted process that doesn't include asking questions just for the sake of asking questions. To me, that's just aimless small talk, and it's not fun.
Of all these questions we've looked at,
not one was from someone who was stuck at a certain point and trying to move forward. None were from someone looking for the key to unlock the next door. They were all spiritual jerk-off questions that you'd expect from people with fearful, ego-reinforcing agendas. That's why I agreed to dry run this process, and that's why I won't be exposing myself to this sort of unstructured dialogue. No one benefits. I'm used to dealing with hungry, desperate, serious people. I'm not going to develop some spiritual bad boy gimmick or crazy wisdom shtick just to shake down the tourists. This is the most wondrous and exhilarating stuff in the world when you take it seriously, and the most dreadful, toxic sludge when you don't. I stand up. I'm sorry to have wasted your time. Mark catches up with me as I'm trying to figure out which elevator button means down. He feels that the meeting actually went pretty well for a first run-through, and that we should get together again. I smile and nod. Then he tells me about a group of people in Queens he gets together with to study the Bhagavad Gita. "There's a meeting tonight," he says, and asks me to attend. I beg out, explaining how tired I am. Bad day, poor sleep, long way home, and all that. But he's insistent, and I'm muddled in the head bone, so I agree to stop by.
Chapter 17 Gita Life. How hath this weakness taken thee? Whence springs the inglorious trouble, shameful to the brave, barring the path of virtue? Nay, Arjun, forbid thyself to feebleness. It mars thy warrior name. Cast off the coward fit. Wake, be thyself, arise, scourge of thy foes. Krishna, Bhagavad Gita. Curtis and I get off the train at the Jamaica station and catch a cab for the 10-minute ride to the address Mark provided. The meeting is in the basement of a church that is Catholic, but not. Some new and improved version that still doesn't have female priests, so not really much of an improvement. There is juice and a platter of butter-free cookies on a table in the back of the room. The stained drop ceiling, enameled cinder-block walls, buzzing fluorescent lights, and cracking linoleum floor tiles are all tinged milky brown from years of cigarette smoke, creating the ambiance of a city morgue that has hosted decades of AA meetings. The long formica tables are sticky, the molded plastic chairs are slippery, the air is stale, I'm tired and hungry, and as if all that's not enough, Curtis is cheerful. The tables are arranged in a large square, and eventually the 30-some-odd people take their seats, 2 and 3 deep in some places. There's a foil-wrapped cardboard cutout of the Om symbol hanging by a thread from the ceiling grid. Curtis asks me what it is, but I'm in no mood to explain sacred syllables to anyone right now. Not that I really could anyway. A tall, thin, mid-30s guy in a ponytail and glasses stands up diagonally to my right and addresses the group. "Good evening, everyone," he begins. And damn me if he's not cheerful, too. What's everyone so happy about? Curtis grins at me. I give him the bad eye in return, but I guess I'm not very good at it because his smile widens. "It's nice to see so many new faces," the speaker continues as my eyes and heart fasten
on the exit sign. Maybe before we get started, we can go around the room quickly and introduce ourselves.
The horror. The horror.
Somehow, this is all my fault. How did I let this happen? I don't mind offending people. Certainly not that Mark guy who, I note with no small degree of resentment, isn't here. So why am I here? Because I was tired. That's how errors happen. That's how toes get stubbed and cars get wrecked. Being tired is the surest way to make a mess. Be well rested is the first rule of life's happy motorist, or maybe second or third, but it's high on the list, right up there with waiting is, think less, and dance more. This whole day has been littered with minor errors that would normally not even be possible, but because I didn't come into it properly rested, it's like I'm sinking into a murky dream state where events conspire against, not for, and where caricaturish, funny-talking creatures abound. "My name is Govinda," says our guide. "I don't really see myself as a teacher so much as a facilitator." He smiles benevolently. My brain has gone numb, and I can't even muster the energy to close my mouth. Govinda has a lilt, I notice, a little sing-song inflection, as if his last gig was in daycare. He continues, "I've been studying Hindu scripture in general, and the Bhagavad Gita in particular, for 15 years. But I like to think that there's still more for me to learn, so, in a way, I'm just a student of the song of the Lord, just like any of you." I do a quick personal inventory and find that I have nothing with which to fashion a noose or open a vein. I wiggle my tongue around in my mouth, but it seems unswallowable. If I have anything approaching a guiding philosophy in life, and I suppose I must, what with being all enlightened and everything, it revolves in very large part around not being in this basement with these people and their tinfoil and their butter-free cookies. I'm simply not a person who does things he doesn't want to. And I like butter.
End of Disc 4.